Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, contributing host Doug Becker explores the post-Bolton foreign policy in the United States. What will become of the National Security Council? Will there be a nuclear arms deal with North Korea?
I'm Doug Becker. On September 10th, 2019, Donald Trump fired National Security Advisor John Bolton. Bolton insisted he resigned. The president reportedly sought to embarrass and denigrate Mr. Bolton, a sort of public defenestration, by firing him before he could formally resign. With the naming of Robert O'Brien as the fourth national security advisor of the first 3 years of the Trump presidency, the marginalization of the National Security Council is apparent. On today's show, we will discuss the future of American foreign policy under Donald Trump, who has insisted he needs no real national security advisor because, quote, I am my own advisor. What are the practical implications of such a position vis-a-vis the National Security Council? And what are some of the specific implications for foreign policy challenges the United States faces in 2019? On today's panel, we have Jeffrey Fields, Associate Professor of the Practice at the University of Southern California and author of Engaging Adversaries, Myths and Realities in American Foreign Policy. Robert Williams, Professor of Political Science and Dean of the Social Science Division at Pepperdine University. He is author with Dan Caldwell of Seeking Security in an Insecure World. Nicholas Rostow, Senior Research Scholar at Yale Law School with a specialization in national security law. He's authored several books and articles, including 9/11 and After, Legal Issues, Lessons in Irregular Conflict, and has extensive experience in policymaking, including as legal advisor to the National Security Council under Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft. And Peter Trumbore, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. He has written Running on Foreign Policy, Examining the Role of Foreign Policy Issues in the 2000, 2002, and 2004 Congressional Campaigns, and his current research focuses on Brexit's impact on the politics of the peace process in Northern Ireland. Jeffrey Fields, let's start with you. What are the institutional implications of the firing of John Bolton and the seeming marginalization of the National Security Council?
Well, I think the first one is really just obvious. There's going to be a different person there, a different personality, and quite a different personality from John Bolton. I think the larger question that you're asking is a little more difficult to answer, not because it's unknowable, but because it's difficult to always figure out what President Trump is doing. I mean, you alluded to this in the introduction. He has strange relationships with people around him. He likes to have people around him, not necessarily for their expertise, but because they're friends, because they're loyal Republicans. And there's an element of that, of course, in every administration. But in this particular position of national security advisor, and I'll speak to the sort of the NSC staff in a second, it remains to be seen what this is going to be like, what Robert O'Brien's relationship is going to be like with President Trump. And I guess I would say there, every administration, whether it's the Trump or Obama or Bush administration, the president's going to have their own kind of relationship with the national security advisor. And whether that person acts in a capacity that seems like the national security advisor, that is going to be the person at the top of the NSC, the way that the statute envisioned it, to just sort of be the person that is at the top of that, doesn't always happen in practice. That person may get sidelined. They may be, as John Bolton tried to do, be there to really sort of inflect their own, you know, policy priorities and worldview on the president. And every president is going to have a different relationship, even in one administration. You mentioned that we're on, you know, National Security Advisor number four, although, you know, Mike Flynn wasn't there very long, so maybe it's sort of 3.5. But I think that's going to be the first thing to try to observe is what is their working relationship going to be like. And Robert O'Brien doesn't have a ton of foreign policy experience. No, he's the special envoy for hostages at state, but he doesn't have a whole lot of, you know, federal government experience. So it's a bit of, you know, a mystery right now in terms of that. I think you're asking also what this means for the NSC and the NSC staff as well. And, you know, there's been a whole lot of hand-wringing and people thinking about the NSC and the NSC staff over the years. And, you know, President Obama came under a little bit of criticism for having such a large NSC staff and so many people, especially in Washington or in government, or how to deal with it in the interagency process, say, this is such a large, bloated organization. You really need to pare it down. And Susan Rice tried to do that in her in our final years there. I don't know that there's any sort of larger implications, because every administration is going to use the staff differently.
And Nicholas Rostow, you have the most experience of any of us on the panel vis-a-vis the National Security Council. How typical or atypical is the current operation of the council, you know, with the important caveat that Jeffrey just gave us, that every president is a bit atypical?
Well, I'd like to answer by going back a little bit in time. It's useful to remember that we went through World War II without a National Security Council. And the National Security Council was created by the National Security Act of 1947, and President Truman didn't like it and only came to use it late in his presidency. And the genius of it is that it's become an indispensable management tool in the foreign and national security area because it's flexible. It can reflect the management preferences and style of different presidents. This president strikes me as not really interested in government. And so it's very difficult to see whether there is, in fact, an NSC interagency process that's recognizable. But Lyndon Johnson once said, you know, the president's entitled to listen to the advice of his chauffeur, and there's nothing Congress can do about it. Congress tried to streamline and regularize presidential decision-making with the National Security Council by creating the National Security Council, but it can't force the president to use it anyway. Each president learns over time that it's a very useful vehicle for managing difficult policy problems that touch many different agencies. This president has a very different style from his predecessors with respect to management and governance. So from an outside point of view, and unless you're inside, you really don't know how things work, it's very difficult to place the Trump administration within the context of the history of the last 70 years or so. That said, obviously John Bolton is a person with a long track record and a lot of strongly held views about things. And Mr. O'Brien doesn't have that track record, doesn't have that public persona. And that could be a tremendous advantage in terms of managing the interagency process and persuading the president to use it and pay attention to it. This president clearly does not like advisors who are in the public eye. So Mr. O'Brien may have an advantage there.
Peter Trembor, your thoughts on the role that the National Security Council might play, or just sort of in general, the role that advisors and experts have and likely will play with this president?
First, let me say thanks for having us on the show today. I think that this is a really interesting case. I think John Bolton was an unusual choice for President Trump, given the huge disparity in their temperaments. I think that Trump was attracted to Bolton because of what he saw of Bolton's performances as a Fox News commentator. In the lead up to Bolton's selection, Bolton was very, very effusive in his praise of President Trump. And I think as we've come to learn, that goes a long way. Flattery goes a really long way with this president. And I don't know that Trump gave much credence or attention to the real big differences in their policy orientations and attitudes when he decided that Bolton was sort of the central casting national security advisor that his administration needed. I think that said, I don't know that this president has much of a regard for anyone's expertise other than his own. And I think that, you know, we've seen that in the nature of the nominations and the appointments he has made sort of across his administration, you know, appointing chief science officers who are not scientists, hand amending weather maps on his own. I just don't know that Trump cares much for expertise. If you go back even to the campaign, with Trump's insistence, for example, that he knew more about any number of topics than the experts, that he knew the military better than the generals, that he knew what to do about the problem of ISIS and terrorism better than anybody, that nobody was better on subject X than Donald Trump. No one does technology better than Donald Trump. So I think that this whole question is kind of spurious, right? I don't think Trump has any respect for or need for any expertise beyond that which his gut tells him is the right thing to do.
With that in mind, let's delve into specific issues. The Trump administration has shown a willingness to use security issues for domestic purposes. Robert Williams, specifically on Ukraine, is the president freestyling his policy, or has he been pretty consistent with his previous policies?
Well, phone calls are a common thing, of course, between American presidents and other leaders, but not typically ones like this one. And of course, we've had the release of the telcon, the summary of this phone call. And frankly, I think those who've seen it so far would say there's nothing exonerating in this near transcript of the conversation. But, you know, I want to make kind of a bigger point, I think, about the way Trump is doing foreign policy and the way it meshes with his personal interests and with his interests in re-election in 2020, the sort of the issues that are at the core of both the Mueller report and now this more recent issue that has finally moved the House leadership toward an impeachment investigation. And that bigger issue is that Trump foreign policy is two very different things. On the one hand, it's Trump making a call like this to President Zelensky. It is Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un. It is Trump having a private conversation with Vladimir Putin. That's part of the Trump foreign policy. But the other part of the Trump foreign policy is what the rest of the administration, in many instances, is trying to do, both to moderate his impulses or to mitigate the impact of some of the things that he's already done. It's what the rest of the administration is trying to do to ensure that there is some normalcy to foreign policy. It's pushing back in ways that are often designed to sort of escape his direct notice. And so we've seen any number of cases where what's coming out of the administration is two different things, depending on whether you're looking at Trump's Twitter feed or what's happening from Secretary Mike Pompeo, or what's happening at lower levels within the administration, trying to conduct a foreign policy as if this were a normal presidency. And it's clearly not.
So Jeff Fields, if this is not a normal presidency, I guess one of the questions is, what would it take to, you know, to return to a normal presidency, or what would a normal policymaking apparatus look like, with the recognition that, I mean, this is a president that values not doing things the old way because the old way was dumb. Is there a middle ground between what seems to be a very unique form and something that might be a little bit more consistent with previous administrations?
I think there is a middle ground. Well, theoretically, I can think of one. I don't think that we can get there with this president. As the other guests here have pointed to, President Trump is not particularly concerned with governance or policy. I mean, that sounds cynical, and you can turn on any cable television show to have lots of people saying the same thing. It just happens to be true, and we can observe it. So the middle ground is, if a person like President Trump decides to not necessarily immerse himself in the details, but get serious about foreign policy and policy and governance. Presidents are always going to disagree with their advisors, and what that looks like in the end is going to depend on the president. But that's where I say there's a middle ground, but I don't know where that is. And I would think if President Trump wins a second term, that it always has the potential maybe to make him a little more relaxed, and I can take some advice and do things slightly different. But it also might empower him to say, well, I don't have to run for re-election. I can do whatever I want. But that's where I would say, can this guy be a normal president? We've seen so many examples where he just can't. I mean, talking about North Korea and Kim Jong-un, you have a staff, an interagency working on this, but then President Trump wants to be the person that's out in front of it. The summit in Singapore's on, then it's off, then it's on, and then he's tweeting directly at heads of state. When you can get that dialed back, he doesn't have to become a foreign policy expert overnight, but that's where I see the middle ground is. He's got to become somebody who takes this more seriously than he does, and where his instincts for governance and foreign policy aren't just about how he looks. With the release of the Ukraine phone readout, if you saw the press conference that he gave in New York at the UN General Assembly, I mean, it was this long, rambling affair where he's still talking about Hillary Clinton's emails and the election and how many electoral votes he won by. He's just not a person particularly interested in foreign policy. So I don't know what the route is to get him more interested in that, but that's where I think that middle ground lies.
Nick Rostow, it's clear that this is a president that doesn't do things in the same way, and there have been a couple of key examples here. But considering that the American security policy have led to policies that may not have necessarily been as much in American interest, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, isn't necessarily a bad thing that we have a president that wants to break with the past.
I think that actions, decisions, non-decisions, they all have consequences. And presidents have to live with their decisions and the consequences of their decisions. Their advisors can always say, sorry, boss, I was wrong, I resign. And I think that whether it's Iran, where a week ago it seemed we were very close to using military force against Iran, although I have no idea what constitutional and statutory authority there would be for such a thing given the present circumstance, but nobody seemed to be asking questions of that sort, or whether it's the consequence of conditioning in any way assistance to Ukraine. I mean, to take Ukraine, our ambassador to the OSCE, James Gilmore, told the head of a Central Asian group or country, I don't remember actually, I saw the email from his press man, I didn't note the name, but he said the United States does not recognize annexation of Crimea by Russia or the incorporation into Russia eastern parts of eastern Ukraine, and insists on the territorial integrity of Ukraine, including Crimea, including Sevastopol. Well, that's a very strong statement by a U.S. ambassador who's a personal representative of the president. Is it U.S. foreign policy? Your guess is as good as mine. I think one of the drawbacks of Trump's management style is the great uncertainty that it creates. But I don't see that changing. I mean, people like myself who've observed this man in New York City for 40 years, I mean, his style as president's exactly the same as his style in New York City, except he's got a better pulpit and he's able to be in everybody's attention span 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which he was not able to do as Donald Trump in New York City. But with respect to his regard for experts, New York City is full of people who are expert in their trade, whether it's lawyers, architects, contractors, who've never been paid by this man, and bankers who won't lend him money. And so he's well known, and there's nothing unusual about his behavior as president compared to his behavior before he became president, or even before he ran for president. So I'm not optimistic that he's going to change, and I think the United States is a very serious member of the international community, and it does help to act in a thoughtful and measured way. We, for good or ill, we're still the leading power, and countries depend on us, and they react to our policy as best they can, but they need to know what it is, and it can't be changing every 20 minutes.
So, Pete Trembor, it seems like one of the themes here is the need for consistency in foreign policy, a predictability so that other leaders know what American policy is and can predict what the American response is. We know the president kind of famously, you know, had declared that unpredictability is something he's going to use to his advantage. Is the president wrong? And there's a need for consistency? And is the inconsistency coming from the fact that rather than having a set of advisors with experience and expertise, that I'll go back to the same word, that he's kind of freestyling foreign policy? I'll ask that first of you, Nick, and then I'll go to Pete.
Want to point out that in a very long article in The Atlantic in April 2016, President Obama said how liberated he felt when he rejected the advice of what he regarded as the Washington foreign policy establishment and did not use force against Syria when his so-called red line was crossed with respect to chemical weapons. So the use of experts is not, it's not the willingness to follow their advice or not follow their advice. As one Foreign Service officer who was very, very good said, we're good sheep, we need good shepherds. And that's the problem. Is there's no real leadership of the government.
Point very well taken. Pete Trembor?
So I'm glad you bring up this question about consistency. And let me preface my remarks with sort of reacting to this Trump's notion that unpredictability on his part is a virtue. I think that Trump was temporarily taken with the crazy Nixon idea. I think that someone probably said something to him. We know that the president is very fond of the last person he talked to. And so my sense is back in the days of sort of the initial fire and fury days of confrontation with North Korea, that someone probably said something about how, you know, the crazy Nixon, that this was a way to deal with the Soviets. And so he was temporarily enamored of that notion for himself. If you actually look at Trump's worldview as it relates to foreign policy, he has been remarkably consistent going back to the mid-1980s. On some very key points. One of them is that Trump believes in purely transactional relationships when it comes to foreign policy and has long argued that American allies rip the United States off, that we pay to defend countries that ought to be paying us for protection, and that this notion of sort of permanent alliances is actually a sucker's game when it comes to sort of American foreign policy. That's an argument he's been making since the 1980s. He's also been arguing since the 1980s that free trade is, again, a loser's bet from the standpoint of the United States, that the United States should play economic hardball in its trade relationships, and that if we're not playing by those rules, then again, people are taking advantage of us. And then the third sort of area of consistency in his worldview has been this longstanding admiration for authoritarians, for demonstrations of strength from leaders. And so if we look at those things, then what we can say is that in the broad brush, both our adversaries and our allies really shouldn't be surprised by the kinds of things that Trump says, tweets, and the policy recommendations that seem to sort of flow endlessly from his whims, impulses, and instincts. It shouldn't surprise us that he throws our longstanding allies sort of under the bus, meanwhile cozies up to, you know, strongmen of every stripe, whether it's Duterte in the Philippines or Erdogan in Turkey, or Sisi in Egypt, who he recently described as his favorite dictator, you know, and the list kind of goes on. So, you know, I think that it's kind of a misnomer, this idea that there's no consistency to Trump's foreign policy. I think what's throwing us is that Trump's sort of internal consistency and coherence is out of step with the way the United States has been doing foreign policy for roughly the last 70 years.
When we come back, the possibility of a nuclear arms deal with North Korea. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How will U.S. foreign policy take shape in the post-Bolton administration? Is the National Security Council being marginalized? Is the president freestyling his policy? How consistent is this with his previous policies? Contributing host Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's panel, we have Jeffrey Fields, associate professor of the practice at the University of Southern California, Robert Williams, professor of political science and dean of the social science division at Pepperdine University, Nicholas Rostow, senior research scholar at Yale Law School with a specialization in national security law, and Peter Trumbor, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Robert Williams, what are the implications of Pete Trumbor's observations on Trump's foreign policy?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with Peter's assessment, and I think he put his finger on three very important consistent elements of Trump's ideas about foreign policy. I don't know that I rise to call it a foreign policy, but his notions, his inclinations on foreign policy, and I think those points are all very well taken. Also well taken, of course, is that there's no consistency to speak of, not a lot at least, with prior American foreign policy. And so I think here's where the rest of the world is having some trouble, at least our allies are having some trouble with this. I think a lot of people, and I'll number myself among them, thought early on that American institutions, whether it be an executive branch that's difficult to turn quickly, whether it's Congress that asserts its own prerogatives, I think a lot of us thought that American institutions might do a better job than they have of standing up to this kind of renegade foreign policy. And so, you know, there are agents and structures in international politics. There are agents and structures in U.S. foreign policy. The structures haven't held very well. And so I think the surprise is that Trump has been able to inject a whole lot more chaos into U.S. foreign policy than perhaps we ever expected. You know, I want to say something about his ideas of deals, you know, himself as the great deal maker. You know, he has this notion, of course, that he has this tremendous ability to make grandiose deals, and that nobody can make deals like he can. He only likes deals that he has made. He's quite willing to pull out of other people's deals. And it appears, in the case of Iran at least, that he's almost willing to go back and make the same deal as long as he can put his own name on it and, you know, not associate it with Obama or not associate it with someone else, even in his own administration. So I think one of the things that happened to John Bolton is that John Bolton got in and thought he could play the role of, you know, one of these foreign policy actors who might be able to steer Trump in a particular way. And I think Trump was to some extent enamored of Bolton early on, not only because of the Fox News appearances and the way Bolton was talking about him on Fox News, but also because I think he saw Bolton as, in some respects, a like-minded iconoclast, somebody who was going to, you know, come in with a wrecking ball in foreign policy the same way that he, Donald Trump, had done. I think where Bolton ran afoul of Trump and of Trump's instincts is when he began to assert himself a little bit more, and when he began to contradict Mike Pompeo. You know, there were reports that Bolton and Pompeo did not speak. They weren't on speaking terms, had to communicate through subordinates. Pompeo's great virtue has been that he never upstages Trump. He never has an idea that, you know, is not Trump's first or that Trump doesn't get credit for. And Bolton wasn't in that league. And that, I think that was his problem. So the Trump foreign policy, it's very personalistic. It's very much him. And, you know, the ability to control for that seems to be far more limited than many of our allies thought or hoped, than many analysts, I think, in the United States had hoped.
And
Doug, can I? Sorry.
Is that Jeff?
Yeah, it's Jeff. Can I just jump one quick point there?
Yeah, just jump right in.
Speaking of Bolton and consistency, one thing I would note about consistency and whether it's foreign policy or worldview is Donald Trump seems very averse to military conflict. And that, I think, is just something to note. And also, it would seem to me that that was just going to make, if it wasn't something else, it certainly would be that was going to inevitably cause a clash with him and John Bolton, who's just a hawk's hawk.
Nick, your thoughts on that?
First of all, I think Peter did a terrific job in reminding us that Trump's core views, I happen to think they're completely wrong and not based on fact, but there you are. To the Bolton point, whatever one thinks of John Bolton, there are few people who know the proliferation dossier better than John Bolton. So he was always going to be a skeptic about the possibility of doing a deal with North Korea and what it could be. He was going to be a skeptic about doing a new deal with Iran of any kind. He was going to be a skeptic on relations with China and relations with Russia. And I think that he knows a great deal about the details of those relations and their history. And that's something that I think Trump would find uncomfortable in anybody.
Robert Williams, building on that question, you know, as well, since the issue of proliferation, one area that we have seen quite a bit of inconsistency with previous administrations has been areas of arms control deals, whether it's the abrogation of deals that have existed since at least the Reagan administration, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, some conversations about whether or not the U.S. should consider modernizing their nuclear forces and even possibly breaking the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, with the caveat the U.S. obviously didn't ratify it, but they have signed it. How much do you see, in particular, if there's a second Trump administration, the future of some of these arms control deals that we tend to view as, you know, as rather iconic and foundational, but suddenly have fallen under political attack?
Well, that's a good point, and I just want to mention that going back to the Eisenhower administration, every single U.S. administration, whether Democratic or Republican, has engaged in arms control and has come away with at least one agreement, and I think in Nixon's case, maybe six significant agreements. And Trump, of course, has not only not reached any arms control agreements, he has, as you mentioned, abrogated the INF Treaty, pulled out of the Arms Trade Treaty, which, of course, was not going anywhere in the Senate anyway, and then pulled out of the Iran deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, not exactly a treaty, but an agreement, broadly speaking. So Trump's instincts on arms control, of course, are, as in many other areas, quite different, quite at odds with his predecessors. I think the fundamental problem goes back to something that Peter mentioned, that he's very, actually, this may have been the point made earlier even, that Trump is very transactional in the way he views the world. He doesn't see any kind of value in long, slow, sustained relationship building, probably doesn't understand the concept of norms in international politics. I think to a considerable extent, all of his instincts are anti-arms control, because arms control requires an awful lot of patience. It requires an awful lot of effort. And what you begin building is not necessarily something that you're going to see to fruition. These are things, agreements in many instances, that take years and multiple administrations to bring to fulfillment. So he's not an arms control president. He's never going to be an arms control president. What's probably a little more troubling even than that, though, however, because we can argue about the value of arms control and whether any of this sort of vast structure of agreements has made all that much difference in the world. Where I think the problem lies, however, is that I don't think Trump even really understands the national security establishment, and especially I don't think he understands nuclear weapons. And so he sees Big Bang. He doesn't see deterrence theory. He doesn't see bargaining theory. There are a lot of things that people have spent a lot of time and energy trying to work out, trying to understand, trying to posit for our leadership that Trump has no concept of. And that's where I think the nuclear policies, the nuclear trial balloons that he's floated, cause a great deal of consternation in the world for good reason.
Although on that point, there is at least one country that he seems to be dedicated to try to get some sort of a deal to finally resolve that deal. And so Peter Trumbore, this really fits, you know, your categories. That country is North Korea, and the kind of personal relationship that the president has sought out with a North Korean leader as a means to try to achieve some victory in arms control. With that in mind, should the U.S. be pursuing any sort of arms control deal with North Korea in order to address that clearly troubling issue of North Korea developing a nuclear weapon? Or is this much more consistent with the idea that the president really enjoys his time with authoritarians?
I think, of course, we should be pursuing some sort of agreement that would rein in North Korea's nuclear ambitions. But I think North Korea and Kim Jong-un are particularly savvy in terms of recognizing very early on that the way to the president's heart is through shameless flattery. You know, how often have we seen and heard President Trump declaiming on the beautiful letters that he has received from Kim Jong-un? And the president seems to go out of his way to excuse the bad behavior of the North Korean regime and of the Kim government so that he can sort of maintain this facade of progress. So yes, should we be trying to make an agreement? Absolutely. Is Trump going to get us there? There's not a chance in the world that what Donald Trump has been doing is going to produce the kind of effect that the president thinks he is headed towards. There have been no commitments made by the North Koreans. In fact, they've continued to test weapons. They've continued to perfect their technologies. And Trump essentially says, yeah, but, you know, these aren't things that they promised. These are not things that Kim promised not to do to me. So, you know, I'm okay, right? These are short and medium range missile tests. And he never promised me that he would stop doing that. So what's the big harm? So the bottom line, right, I think in a lot of this conversation we've been having, whether we go back to Trump's differences with John Bolton, and especially on this question of the use of military force, is that one of the lasting harms that Trump has done to American foreign policy is he has eviscerated our credibility. Trump blusters and bluffs and threatens, and going back to his business career, he just does not follow through. The tool that Trump relied on as a businessman was the threat of lawsuit. And he very rarely followed through on that. And one of the hallmarks of his presidency so far has been the threat of military action, even as it is well known that he has this very strong aversion to the use of military force. So So he talks a big game, but no one believes it. And the danger with that is there may come a point where we actually have to use force, but no one is going to believe that Trump will follow through. And so I think that's inherently dangerous. The other thing that he has done by essentially ripping up these agreements that prior administrations had committed themselves to, whether they're arms control or trade agreements or whatever, is he has essentially destroyed the understanding that successor governments in the United States will honor the commitments made by previous presidencies. And that's actually really bad. It's bad now, and it's going to be especially bad in the future, because our partners are going to look at this and they're going to say, well, what's going to stop whoever follows Trump from following the same playbook? We can't trust the word of the United States any longer. And that's just a recipe for trouble from the standpoint of, you know, American national interests and the predictability that I think we would all agree is essential for international stability and order.
Jeffrey Fields, actually, what Peter just said seems to also fit well with the notion of the difficulty of arms control agreements, and that the president, by most accounts, doesn't have the kind of patience to work through a long negotiation and even his use of summitry. I always find myself telling my classes that leaders don't go to summit meetings until there's a deal ready to be struck. This president loves to go on summit meetings, doesn't really have a deal, figures if he sits down, he'll get something, and has not been successful, you know, clearly in North Korea. Do you agree with this assessment that the likelihood of any sort of a deal with North Korea is pretty low? And, you know, sort of your thoughts on the idea of just using summit diplomacy rather than, you know, traditional arms control or, you know, traditional types of negotiations to try to get that deal?
I think the probability of getting a deal is pretty low, but not for exactly the same reasons that you laid out. I think it's pretty low because it's just going to be incredibly difficult. Donald Trump, we could say he has very little patience, but lots of American presidents, especially a lot of Republican presidents lately, have demonstrated the same thing with North Korea. I mean, we're in uncharted territory here. We have one state that's ever denuclearized, and they didn't really want their weapons that they had, and they only had six. To fully denuclearize North Korea would be an incredibly long, taxing process. There'll be fits and starts. They walk away from the table. They'll be accused of cheating. There will be all sorts of political pressure on a president to walk away from a deal. And that would test any president, but especially one like Donald Trump, who does not want to immerse himself in the details, that has a very short attention span. But as it goes to summitry, this is where I do think a little bit differently, and I give him a little bit of credit, because if you're going to try to crack a nut that tough, I think a president should be willing to do that. I mean, when candidate Obama on the 2008 campaign trail talked about his willingness to meet with leaders of Iran or wherever without precondition, and he was just roundly eviscerated by that. Senator McCain talked about how naive he was, and then, you know, we have to bring up the Munich analogy there. And as, you know, people on the other side would point out, well, you know, if you're going to get a deal, you're going to have to negotiate with your adversary. Don't negotiate peace with your friends. And I give Trump credit for that. Where he falls down on is, yes, he does fall back into that. He sees foreign policy as a transactional thing, and he's more about the photo op and holding up the piece of paper that they've signed that doesn't really say anything than getting into the nitty-gritty of it. But there he is sitting in the room, first American president to meet the leader of North Korea. I'm a big proponent of, well, go see what happens. You know, what it can't be worse than where we are right now. The Bush administration came in 2000, 2001 and walked away from the agreement we had, the agreed framework negotiated in the Clinton administration. They had their reasons for doing that, some having to do with the specifics and some having to do with, you know, wanting to walk away from something that President Clinton had negotiated. But if you talk to those people, they would say, well, they cheated on this, they're doing this, so we can't do that, they're not serious. Well, where did that get us in those 8 years of the presidency? In 2000, North Korea hadn't tested a nuclear weapon, and now they've tested six times. So if you sat down and negotiated with them face-to-face there at a very high level in 2001 on what's the worst that could have happened? You could have reached their first, you know, the first test or the end of that, those 2 terms of President Bush, and nothing would have been accomplished. You would have wasted some time, money, jet fuel. So what? That's where we are right now. So I do give, you know, Trump credit for that. And the same thing with Iran. I mean, it's been sort of back and forth. Before this, the latest flare up, it kind of seemed like he might actually meet with President Rouhani in New York. He's perfectly willing to do that. Not a lot of other presidents would be willing to do that. But especially for North Korea, it's going to take some creativity and patience. And so, yeah, that you know, Trump may have that in terms of let's go to Hanoi, let's go to Singapore. But there's no follow through on that. That's just going to be incredibly difficult. I mean, it's going to be incredibly difficult for the next president after President Trump. And just quickly on INF. You know, President Trump doesn't really seem to care about the nitty-gritty of arms control or really understand nuclear strategy on the campaign trail. He, you know, you may remember he was asking the CNN debate about if he would eliminate one of the legs of the triad, and he clearly had no idea what the triad was. But on the INF treaty, I mean, can't really put that on Trump, but the Russians were cheating on it, and this goes back to the Obama administration. I was working at the State Department then, and you know, the question was, what do? We know they're cheating. The question was, do we confront them? Do we confront them publicly? And a lot of hand-wringing and decision to just, well, let's just punt on this. But that was going to be probably inevitable. That treaty was going to fall apart.
This is Nick Rostow.
Yes, Nick.
Boy, there's a lot to react to here. But on the INF treaty, I mean, I served in the Reagan administration when the INF treaty was negotiated. And, of course, the Russians had violated the ABM treaty very substantially, but it was useful to hit them over the head in negotiations about it rather than tear up the ABM treaty. And I think that the fact that the Russians were violating the INF treaty gave us a good lever, and we weren't using it. So I'm not sure I would agree with that it would be good, but I would just like to offer the perspective of a former NSC staffer on this whole question of personal diplomacy by a president. The president doesn't get any points. The president's prestige is not enhanced by meeting with Kim Jong-un or President Rouhani and not getting a new deal. But meeting with the president is a huge prestige windfall for somebody like Kim Jong-un or President Rouhani. And so a NSC staffer would remind the president to think seriously about what he would be giving or she would be giving to an adversary or an interlocutor by meeting with him. That's one thing that this president doesn't seem to think about. The other thing is what's interesting, take NAFTA. He said it was the worst agreement ever negotiated. Well, nobody was complaining about it, and it seemed to work very well. And the new agreement that he negotiated is a tweak. It's sort of NAFTA plus a little bit, but it's renamed. And does that mean that he would sort of re-enter the Clinton administration agreement with North Korea, only call it the Trump administration agreement? Would he re-enter a JCPOA with Iran and just with a tweak? That's not really accomplishing very much.
This is Pete Trumbore.
Yes, go ahead, Pete.
I wanted to sort of add to that a little bit. I appreciate the perspective that Jeff is bringing, and I sort of get the idea that maybe Trump deserves some credit for being willing to sit down and talk with these other heads of states that we've had these fraught relations with. That's all well and good. And I would be absolutely okay with that if I thought that Trump was doing the homework necessary to walk into those situations and to be able to negotiate some kind of agreement from a position of solid information and preparation. But we know the president doesn't read. We know the president doesn't listen to briefings. We know the president believes that his gut is superior to the expertise of his advisors. Yeah, so whether we're talking about, you know, Kim Jong-un or Rouhani of Iran or bringing the Taliban to Camp David just before 9/11 so that Trump could negotiate the final details of an American withdrawal from Afghanistan, to me, all of this is about the optics and not about the substance. I don't think Trump has any interest in the substance. I think Trump is interested in the presentation. He's interested in the spectacle. He's interested in the stroking of his own ego. I don't think he cares one bit about the extent to which this elevates the people that he's sitting down across the table from. I think Trump, it's all about him. And if it wasn't that way, I'd be completely, you know, supportive of Jeff's position that Trump deserves this credit for sitting down and talking where others wouldn't. But I can't really go there.
This is Jeff. Can I?
Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Just a quick there. You know, maybe I shouldn't have used the word credit. I guess I would say it this way, which is we've seen so much of the opposite in the past, which is you have an administration that has the advisors, has people there to give the advice and to see this through, could negotiate an agreement with an adversary. And then you have a president who is too afraid of the optics of it. It says, no, you can't do that. And like, you know, what I mentioned, you know, candidate Obama and all the grief that he got for just saying that is what I mean. It's like so many people are just so opposed to the idea of the notion. And it's inconsistent, right? We can't do that. These are terrible people. He's a dictator. Well, we deal with dictators all the time. Saudi Arabia, I think that's coming up later. And so, yeah, I get it. You know, that's the maddening thing about it is Trump is willing to do that. He's unwilling to actually read a briefing book or to immerse himself in the details of it. He was just, you know, willing to do something that a lot of presidents aren't. And then that just kind of becomes a non-starter for everything. Think of the outreach that the Iranians gave to the United States in the early 2000s, the letter they sent in 2003 to the Bush administration that just went nowhere. And it stated whether you believe that they were sincere or not. But yeah, let's talk about everything. Let's talk about all the things that critics of the JCPOA say. It doesn't cover this. The Iranians said that they were willing to talk about it in 2003. And the Bush administration didn't want to listen to him. I talked to a senior Bush administration official about that. And what he told me was profane. I can't repeat it here about that outreach from the Iranians. So, you know, at least Trump is slightly different in that. And let's see what we can do. We don't have to keep them in arms length just because.
This is Peter again. I just want to respond to Jeff just for a second, because, you know, I agree. I didn't have the same reaction to Obama's suggestion that he would sit down with the Iranians, in part because I had no doubt that we would be prepared for that meeting, that a normal president walking into a meeting like that would be properly prepared and would have an idea of what he wanted to accomplish and wouldn't just be winging it. And I think my problem with Trump is that I have no confidence that he's going to walk into a situation like that with anything other than what he believes his gut tells him to do. And frankly, that's not a sound basis to craft this country's foreign policy.
This is Nick Rostow. I could give you a little historical example of the consequences of presidents. You know, the two most feared words in Washington are principles only. That is to say, a meeting only of principles, because they tend not to know what the hell they're talking about. And there was a meeting between President Reagan and Prime Minister Mulroney of Canada. And Mulroney wanted the United States to agree that all the waters of northern Canada were part of Canada. And the president looked at the globe in his office and said, sure. Well, you know, some of those waterways are hundreds of miles wide. The Navy went ballistic, but the commander-in-chief had spoken. And so there can be serious consequences for presidents who go into meetings ill-prepared and say things. And I quite agree that a well-prepared president is, like any negotiator, is better off than one who's not. And that's not Trump's style.
And Doug, I have a brief comment.
Please do. Robert.
So I rarely have ever found myself expressing sympathy for John Bolton in any situation. But I find myself imagining what his blood pressure must have been contemplating Donald Trump on the phone or in a meeting with Kim Jong-un or with President Rouhani. he must have just been apoplectic about that possibility of something being done in ignorance with either of those states.
I'm going to give Robert the last word on that as we've come.
Well,
oh, go ahead.
If I could just add one other thing. The other thing about Bolton, just to bring it back around to him, North Korea back in May issued a statement calling him a warmonger and a defective human product. And I've got to believe that that's on his resume right now.
That is actually a perfect ending to our conversation. Thank you very much to our guests. I think we've raised a number of significant issues for consideration. And ultimately, suffice to say, the Chinese like to wish that may you live in interesting times. As someone who studies foreign policy, I have to admit I wish they were a little bit less interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
We had with us Jeffrey Fields, Associate Professor of the Practice at the University of Southern California and author of Engaging Adversaries, Myths and Realities in American Foreign Policy. Robert Williams, Professor of Political Science and Dean of the Social Science Division at Pepperdine University. He is author with Dan Caldwell of Seeking Security in an Insecure World. Nicholas Rostow, Senior Research Scholar at Yale Law School with a specialization in national security law. He's authored several books and articles, including 9/11 and After, Legal Issues, Lessons in Irregular Conflict, and has extensive experience in policymaking, including as legal advisor to the National Security Council under Colin Powell and Brent Scowcroft. And Peter Trumbore, Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. He has written Running on Foreign Policy, Examining the Role of Foreign Policy Issues in the 2000, 2002, and 2004 Congressional Campaigns, and his current research focuses on Brexit's impact on the politics of the peace process in Northern Ireland.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.